The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Miriam J.A. Chancey is titled, Haiti's Uncertain Future and What We Must Learn From It. August 14th, just a little over a month after the assassination of the Haitian president, a magnitude 7.2 earthquake rocks Haiti, a small island nation shaped like a scorpion's claw. Unlike the last one in 2010, this one erupts in broad daylight. The damage is clear and immediate. By evening, Haitians across the country decide to sleep in their yards, wherever they can find open space, some by choice, others not. Haitian friends post about the pain of being Haitian. Wherever they find themselves, most don't sleep, or if they do, they are dreamless. On the evening of August 16th, Tropical Storm Grace makes landfall, and the thousands sleeping under the stars have nowhere to turn. Those with tarps lose them to the winds. An uncle sends me coverage by a local journalist showing an elderly woman trying to make her way across a field after her makeshift shelter blows away. I can't watch this, he says, as he sets down his microphone and asks his cameraman to help. They pick up the woman like a child and yell to those nearby to take her in. Others, especially those in far-flung towns and villages beyond Les Cayes, will remain inaccessible, will be waiting for food, shelter, clothing, medical aid. What comes next does not need to be imagined because it has happened before, is happening now. Foreign food staples are flown in as goodwill gestures, but have the effect of wiping out local suppliers and producers in the process. My mother used to call me to interpret dreams. Weeks into 2010, she called to tell me a story that sounded like a dream, about a man who was seen descending from his home, immaculately dressed every morning, into the ruins of Port-au-Prince. He did this for weeks, and the rumor circulated that he'd lost his mind. Maybe it's his way of coping, I said. My mother continued with the tale of a family member who lived through the earthquake and was encouraged to leave Port-au-Prince for Miami after months of burying the dead. He didn't stay in the U.S. long. He returned to Port-au-Prince because, he said, everyone there was suffering in the same way and understood what they were experiencing when someone jumped into the street or screamed out in their sleep. It was easier to bear the memories in like company. At last report, despite $13 billion in aid poured into the country after 2010, there are still 50,000 people sleeping under tents in Port-au-Prince. Many more live with the memory of tremors and falling walls, the memory of a city that looked detonated after 45 seconds of the earth shaking, the memory of the dead, many covered over with debris, others never to be found. As the earth shakes once more, many have still not recovered from those previous losses. Witnessing the second earthquake from far away, there is an overwhelming sense of disarray, of emptiness. The recollections of 2010 come flooding back. On January 12, 2010, I was about to walk into a classroom when I received several messages. Earlier in the day, we had celebrated my father's 75th birthday by phone. I turned it off. When I emerged 3 hours later, I was to find that at 4:53 p.m., as I had been making my way to class, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake had hit Haiti with such force that national landmarks had been decimated. The first images out of Port-au-Prince would be of the fallen walls of the once majestic Cathedral of Our Lady of the Assumption, also called the Notre Dame Cathedral, the dome of the Capitol building, Haiti's White House, collapsed as if an ornament on a cake. Phone lines were down or jammed for days, and it was impossible to know who was dead or alive. Those images confirmed that the unimaginable had happened after so much else, hurricanes, dictatorship, occupation. Within weeks, we would learn that all of Haiti's leading women activists had died that day. Magalie Marcelin, Anne-Marie Coriolan, Miriam Merlet, among them. In a few months, the numbers tallied, 250,000 dead, 300,000 injured and an equal number of buildings lost. 1.5 million left homeless. In Cincinnati, where I was living at the time, the response to the earthquake was muted. I helped organize a fundraiser, but colleagues and acquaintances soon put the event behind them. I swam in a blur. A weight swept over me. I could not leave my apartment. When I tried to go for a walk to get my mind on other things, rays of sun felt like shards of glass against my skin. Survivor's guilt or something else. It hurt to feel the aliveness of things. A friend invited me to lunch, and I tried to explain the heaviness of accumulating losses. My well-meaning friend responded by saying that the drift of one's childhood was inevitable, that I needed to put this behind me. I retreated to my apartment. For those of us with ties to Haiti, there was no putting behind. The death toll of the 2010 earthquake matched the population of Cincinnati, and I realized that hardly any U.S. resident would be able to even imagine waking up one morning to find their American landscape wiped out, destroyed. Disasters happen elsewhere, never at home, until they do. Months later, I found out that the dreamlike story my mother had shared was my cousin's. An engineer by training, he had been hired to assess buildings in the capital because none of his buildings in Port-au-Prince had fallen. Evaluations sometimes entailed crawling into the debris. Since many structures were unstable and anything could happen, he chose not to tell anyone what he was doing until the job was done. When I eventually returned to Haiti, it is this cousin who showed me around. What I saw stunned me, from the makeshift camps crowding open spaces to the rubble piled high as mountains to clear the roads, broken buildings everywhere. My mother had asked me to check on the house of a friend, close to the cathedral, in her old neighborhood, a once middle working class area. We found only rubble, a door propped up against a frame standing without walls. My mother's friend, a former nun, dreamt of rebuilding. A man came out of nowhere to tell me not to take a picture. I explained that I was asked to take a photograph for the owner. The man was uncertain. He told me he was hired to guard the house. I looked back at the rubble. Then I recognized the turn of the road. I remember the house as it once was, a classic gingerbread. The last time I was there, in my mid-20s, my parents' friend had a table in the foyer covered in plastic, under which she placed the photographs of all those whom she loved who were no longer in Haiti. I spotted my mother and father and myself as an 8-year-old, someone's memory. My mother's friend had survived so many things, but a few years after this she died, without her home, without the dreams accumulated there. My cousin took me to see the fallen national landmarks, to see Notre Dame. Once so majestic, its rose walls are now fissured and crumbled. Despite being in ruins, the building was still imposing. We contemplated it in silence. There was nothing to say. As I took pictures, I saw movement from the left side of my camera. A young woman was walking hurriedly towards us with a baby in hand. My cousin tells me that there is a camp set up in front of the cathedral that we should go. The moment of turning away is heavy, but my cousin is right. There is little we can do. Later, I think about the age of the baby and realize that it was born in the camps. Shortly after internally displaced persons, or IDP camps, sprung up throughout the city, there were widespread reports of sexual violence against women, children, and other vulnerable groups. Women's watchdog groups warned that girls especially would be forced into prostitution, that it was crucial that Haitian women have a seat at decision-making tables. This was not to happen. The Commission of Women for Victims, formed in 2004 by a group of Haitian women survivors of political rape to assist new victims of sexual violence, worked tirelessly after 2010 in an effort to bring perpetrators to justice and to foster healing. There is a long history of gendered abuse in Haiti. During the Duvalier regime, feminists were intimidated, tortured, raped. Nearly 100 years before, during the U.S. occupation of Haiti in the early 20th century, James Weldon Johnson collected information on behalf of the NAACP, documenting similar abuses by U.S. Marines. Before that, as in all plantation systems, rapes of enslaved women by colonials were common. More recently, in 2017, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, or MINUSTAH, begun in 2004, was brought to an end, in part because of allegations that UN officers committed gendered crimes in Haiti as far back as 2007, leaving behind fatherless children. While such violence against women and girls by UN soldiers was widespread, there appears to be only one conviction on record for the rape of a 14-year-old boy. The removal of agricultural tariffs on imported food designed to protect Haiti's own domestic production of rice and other staples precipitated another gendered crisis. After the earthquake, small producers begged for the opportunity to feed the country. They were denied. The majority of Haiti's farmers were women. Today, after the earthquake in August, fears of insecurity were resurrected as tropical storms swept through the region. I've tried to imagine what it must have been like to be that young mother I encountered in 2010, living under a tent at the foot of the broken cathedral, without clean water for herself and her child, exposed to strangers and the elements. She is one of many who were forced to defer their dreams or put them aside entirely. Photographs have begun to emerge of earthquake survivors huddled under makeshift dwellings. One is of a small child smiling up at his mother. She can be seen smiling back even though they are both barely covered by tarps that appear left over from the last disaster, offering little protection from whipping rains. Somehow their smiles betray hope, but is their hope warranted? As in 2010, after this summer's earthquake, it will be up to locals to set up security patrols, and still, this will not offer enough protection from predation. For these reasons, the Haiti Response Coalition, formed in April 2020 by a wide range of collaborative grassroots organizations to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, is circulating a call for all those operating on the ground in Haiti to establish new minimum standards to uphold the dignity, respect, and leadership of Haitians while operating with transparency and inclusivity. Haitian asylum seekers recently gathered in Del Rio, Texas, are indirectly related to the events of this summer, but directly related to those of 2010. Most have been making their way from South America to Central America to the U.S. from locations as far as Brazil and Chile, countries which, after 2010, opened their borders to Haitian immigrants, only to progressively restrict their admission. Despite being initially welcomed, they soon were met with racism and xenophobia. With the spread of COVID-19 leading to the decimation of economies and employment throughout the global South, and the possibility of return foreclosed for both political and natural causes, Haitian migrants have had little choice but to be on the move, fueled by the false hope of a more welcoming administration. However, the images of migrants being greeted by Texas Rangers on horseback, using their reins as whips to run down adults and children alike as they attempted to cross the Rio Grande on foot, holding bags of food above their heads for family members waiting in the migrant camp in Del Rio, are stark reminiscent of the antebellum South. I currently live in California, and I have since learned that the protocols my cousin used to assess buildings in 2010 were developed here and adapted for Haiti. Californians fear the big one. They joke about it. Golf, swim, go to school, go to restaurants, get married, divorced, and everything in between. The inevitable is deferred. What if Haiti is just a mirror of who we might all be in the future? If this is so, then what are we prepared to do now so that mothers here and in Haiti can rock their children to sleep without fear of dreaming for a better future? Our next article by Naomi Barr is titled, Yes, Journaling Can Change Your Life. Here's how. When it comes down to it, becoming your best self is a task that only you can take on. That's where journaling comes in. Devotees and researchers alike will tell you that the practice of writing out your thoughts can help you organize your thinking, work through complicated emotions, and tune into your creativity. We all walk around assuming that we know what's on our mind, but we often don't, says Beth Jacobs, PhD, a clinical psychologist, lifetime journaler, and author of Writing for Emotional Balance. Every time I write, an idea will come out on the page that I never would have known was buried somewhere in my brain. No matter how long you've been doing it, something transformative usually happens when you make a creative space like this for yourself. But sometimes the thought of writing down your thoughts can feel daunting or too time-consuming. That's why we're offering a guide to help. Whether you're a dedicated journaler or a hesitant first-timer, these tips will inspire you to put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard. As you flip through these pages, you've got just one goal. Explore the things that shake you up as well as the things that bring you joy, says writer Alexandra L., who leads journaling workshops and is author of the guided journal, Encourage. When you stay curious, you can become your own greatest teacher. Keep your memory and thinking sharp. Writing can help still your mind, which allows you to remember and recall memories better, think more creatively. It can also help you come up with interesting connections between observations or ideas that you might not have otherwise, says James Pennebaker, PhD, the University of Texas at Austin psychology professor, whose pioneering work has helped shape the scientific research behind journal-style writing. Sleep better. Journaling, especially at night, may help you fall asleep faster as well as improve the quality of your sleep. Researchers believe that dealing with things that are on your mind prior to sleep helps alleviate worries and negative thoughts that might otherwise disrupt your slumber. Boost your mood. Studies show that writing about your feelings appears to help regulate parts of the brain related to processing emotions, which can leave you feeling calmer and happier. Also, if you do end up sleeping better, you're less likely to experience depression and feelings of sadness, says Pennebaker. Reduce your blood pressure, stress, and anxiety. Researchers believe that writing helps break the cycles of rumination and worry that often accompany troubling thoughts or experiences. When those are chronic, your body and mind stay on high alert, which keep blood pressure, stress hormones, and anxiety levels elevated. Expressive writing. With this, you can write about anything that's bothering you or generally weighing on you. It can sometimes be a stupid thing, like being upset that the airline lost your luggage, or something really positive, like you just got engaged. What writing does is provide some structure and understanding to what you're experiencing, says Pennebaker. Stream of consciousness. No proofreading, no overthinking. Just transcribe whatever pops into your head for a specific period of time or page count. You can set it. Julia Cameron, the author of the best-selling book The Artist's Way, popularized this kind of writing with her prescription to do daily morning pages. The idea there was to commit to 3 pages of stream of consciousness writing first thing in the morning. Gratitude lists. This is an easy way to start journaling for those who've never done it before, says Lori Santos, PhD, the Yale professor of psychology, whose class on the science of happiness, which included doing gratitude lists, made national headlines when it became the most popular course in the college's history. You simply write down 3 to 5 things every day that you're grateful for. That's it. One sentence a day. For some people, less is more. I had a fantasy of myself writing deep thoughts in a journal, but it just wasn't realistic for me. So I wrote 1 sentence a day, which was totally manageable, says Oprah Daily columnist Gretchen Rubin, author of The Happiness Project. Reading over entries, you start to see patterns emerging. You're able to make more sense of your life. And as you start to put a narrative around your life, you find more meaning to it. Feeling stuck? Here's the honest truth. There will be days when you just don't feel like writing. These 4 tips may help. Use tools that will make you want to write. For some, that means a fancy pen and luxe stationery. Others may feel less intimidated using a legal pad. That works as well. Try to write a little bit every day, especially if you're new to it. And we mean a little bit. But if you end up sitting and staring at a blank page for 10 minutes before moving on to other things, that's okay. It's all about creating a habit. There's no right time to write. This is your place of reprieve and reflection, so you set the terms, says Elle. First thing in the morning, before bed, middle of the day, just experiment. You'll probably discover you have a time of day that's most conducive for you. There's nothing wrong with doodling. Sometimes if I can't get the words together to explain my thoughts or observations, I'll just draw in my journal, says Jacobs. You may find it gives your brain the break it needs, too. Your creative space. These notable names take us inside the spaces and share the tools and daily inspirations that keep them creative and help the words flow. Let these women motivate you and explore all the My Creative Space columns on OprahDaily.com. Gloria Steinem, feminist writer and activist. Whenever I feel blocked, I'll start writing by hand. One of Alice Walker's books is titled A Poem Traveled Down My Arm, and I think that perfectly captures the feeling. It's visceral, and I almost always use a Uniball Vision Elite pen. Whereas pencils have to continuously be sharpened, these pens keep going for a long time. I also feel having a bulletin board nearby is essential. It's a place of both urgency and memory. I can display photographs of people I care about, reminders of emails or projects that need to be addressed immediately, and things that inspire outrage. Yvonne Orie, comedian, writer, and actor on HBO's Insecure. My best ideas usually come when I'm lying in bed or I'm in the shower. Same applies to the bathtub. I have tables set up next to it, so I might journal. I'll ask, what do I need to know? And eventually an answer comes. As soon as it does, I write it down. Adi Bryant, Saturday Night Live cast member and star and co-writer of Hulu's Shrill. I have this little ritual I pretty much always do. I wake up, stretch for about 20 minutes on a yoga mat next to my bed, and clean up my room. Once I've done all of that, I'll get back into bed, but this time in a seated position, and set up my little pillow desk. I also like to have a big-ass jug of water nearby. I truly feel that's part of the writing process. Sipping, looking, thinking, and sipping. The power of vision boards. Proof that creating a visual representation of your dreams and goals can be potent. 1 in 5 small business owners have said they used vision boards when starting their business, and of that group, 76% reported they achieved all that they envisioned. By staying focused on the changes you want to see in your future, you are more likely to put the work in toward achieving them. Life coach Ziva Bilel, who leads vision board workshops and uses them with her clients, shares 3 tips on how to begin one of your own. Set a timer for 15 minutes. Cut and gather images from old magazines or print some off the internet that spark joy or tug on your heart. Don't judge. Let your subconscious take over. Take the next 30 minutes to narrow down the images. Ask yourself what feels most essential and what can be given up. You'll start to see connections or themes and can organize accordingly. Then start pasting. Find the meaning. Ask yourself, what do I see that surprises me? What do I love the most? What confuses me? What areas do I want to explore more? Write answers in a journal, then commit to 5 action steps to move your visions forward. Bonus tip, creating mini vision boards in the pages of your journal around specific topics, think work, relationships, etc., is a great way to keep your inspiration with you at all times. Get inspired. These readers share how vision boarding helped turn thoughts into reality. I made a vision board soon after I divorced and put images on it of things I wanted to bring into my life. There was a shot of a house with a pool, an image of a sailboat, and a photo of some guy because I wanted to get married again. He had shaggy brown hair, reading glasses, and was wearing a white shirt and jeans. About a year or so later, I ended up meeting a man who looks just like that photo. Since then, we've gotten married, gone sailing together, bought a home, and we just had a pool delivered. Samantha Smith, Los Angeles. A while back, I thought, I'd like to feel happier. So each week I pasted images into a vision book that reminded me to generate more laughter in my life. I wrote things like watch something funny, tell 3 jokes, laugh at others' jokes. Then I practiced all of that. Now every day I try to live the most joyful life possible. Jania Hale, Austin, Texas. After leaving my job at a talent and media company, I created a vision board to help me figure out what to do next professionally. All the images I chose ended up relating to travel and wellness. I thought, what can I do with this? But reflecting on it prompted me to complete a yoga training program. After that, I started teaching yoga classes for children and adults, and now I'm creating holistic health content and experiential programs that I hope will be used by companies worldwide. Delphine Tordman-Lipsick, Paris. a note from Oprah. I've been journaling since I was 15. It's a wonder that I've managed to be a successful human being, considering how pathetic I appeared in many of my daily musings. It's a testament to growth and grace that I've come this far. I wrote a lot of bad poetry in my teens and 20s, mostly about how some guy had done me wrong. I used my journals as therapy. Oh, the time I wasted worrying about men and weight and what other people thought. In my 40s, I got wiser. I started using journals to express my gratitude and watched my blessings multiply. What you focus on expands. Now I do a combination of gratitude and trying to give some perspective to whatever I'm writing about. I prefer unlined paper to lined, and I also have an iPad app for journaling. It's astonishing to be able to track your own evolution, who I was, who I'm still becoming. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, For Sutton Foster, Crafting is the Key to Happiness and Sanity. 7 years of starring in the publishing industry set TV show Younger didn't prepare Sutton Foster for writing her first book. I don't think I really understood the world of publishing until working on this, the 46-year-old Broadway vet tells Oprah Daily over the phone while strolling to the theater in London where she's currently starring in Anything Goes. The very first time I walked into a publishing house was for pitching this book. I was like, maybe I should have done more research before doing Younger. Hooked, How Crafting Saved My Life, is a memoir about how Foster's longtime love of, you guessed it, crafting, provided an outlet for her life as a performer and for her often vexed relationship with her mother. Foster's mom, Helen, suffered from agoraphobia, though her mental illness was never diagnosed, nor was it treated. As Helen retreated from the world, her relationship with her children, Foster and her brother Hunter, frayed. Helen didn't speak to her son for a decade, disapproving of his romantic decisions. She and Foster had a rocky relationship, too. Many of the stories in Hooked have yet to be told publicly. I'm excited to share it with the world, but I feel very vulnerable, she says. Throughout the book, Foster expresses her fear that she would somehow morph into her mother. During her breakthrough Broadway role in Thoroughly Modern Millie, Foster wondered, had I inherited my mother's antisocial genes? Due to the pressure of the role, Foster isolated herself from the rest of the cast. In times like those, Foster turned to crafting to ease anxiety and remember who she was. As a result, Foster's memoir is structured around the key crafts she's taken solace in. The owls she stitched when her mom was diagnosed with melanoma, after a tumor the size of a grapefruit was found on her thigh. Though Helen had been bedridden for 3 months from the illness, she refused to go to the hospital. The blanket she crocheted while she was going through a divorce from actor Christian Borle. The 10 original baby blankets she made while awaiting the arrival of her daughter, Emily Dale, whom she and her husband Ted Griffin adopted in 2017. On set, I was making out with Peter Herman, one of my love interests and Younger. In my dressing room, I was crocheting a pink dinosaur for Emily, Foster writes in Hooked. Even the albino octopus toilet paper wrapper she gave as a wedding present to her Younger co-star Hilary Duff makes an appearance. What else do you get Hilary Duff for a wedding present, she jokes. While on set, Foster and Duff, who is a big knitter, would craft together. We spoke to Foster about what she learned from playing Liza on Younger, the concept of a divorce blanket, and how crafting really did save her life. Oprah Daily. In Hooked, you describe making 4 portraits for 4 Broadway characters you played. What would Liza from Younger's portrait look like? Sutton. Oh my gosh, my character portrait of Liza. It's a little more complicated because I was with her for 7 years, which was a big chapter in my own life. My mom died, I met my husband, I adopted my daughter, and I became a mom. Liza was a reinvention. I came into my own, not in a dramatic way. I became the best version of myself. Oprah Daily. You share things in the memoir that you haven't spoken of publicly, especially about your family. Sutton. My intention was really to show the positive choices that I made, how I handled the complications of my life. I wanted to share the story of my mother because it was this thing I had for such a long time. It's a huge part of me. It defines me in many ways. The intention wasn't to be this tell-all about my mother. I wanted to approach it in a way that honored my mom, but also allowed me to share where I came from, how I overcame it, and the tools I used to navigate the hard times. And through that, hopefully I'll be able to relate to other people who have gone through similar struggles. That was my intention. Maybe it might help someone else. Oprah Daily. In a New York Times interview, Patti LuPone says you exude a positive light. Do you ever wonder where that quality comes from? Sutton. It's so interesting being the daughter of my mother. My mother was in darkness. She was afraid of life. I think the light-seeking was in contrast to that, honestly. I think it is a part of who I am intrinsically and inherently. Growing up, I recognized that in her and chose the other direction. Oprah Daily. The book is so cleverly divided up into crafts. Looking ahead in the project, was there one you were dreading writing about? Sutton. The hardest chapter was the divorce blanket chapter. It was one of the things I spoke about when pitching the book. I had this blanket that I made that I put together 2 years after a bad breakup. When it came to writing it, I was having to dive back into this time, which was so sludgy and painful. I was very scared to delve into that time of my life. That took the hardest time to excavate. Oprah Daily, did you sit next to the divorce blanket as you wrote about? Sutton. You know what's weird about the divorce blanket? It has so much energy in it. I don't know where to put it. It's beautiful, but it represents something that's really tricky. Right now it's in the guest room. I'll let the guests deal with the energy of it. I can't put it on my bed with my husband. That's weird. It has stuff going on, but it did hang out with me. These objects retain so much energy. It's like a time capsule of when I made it and what was happening. And these things will live on, hopefully, after I'm gone. What will its life be? Oprah Daily. Big picture. What did crafting do for you that other art forms haven't or couldn't? Sutton. They're my number one tool. They are healing. My relationship to crafting changed over the years. Most of the time, I go to them when I'm having a particularly tricky time, almost like journaling. I can work things out when I'm crocheting. It's evolved with my daughter. The crafts have become a little more joyful. That's why I chose that as a theme of the book. Yes, I'm a singer and an actor and a dancer. I do all these things. But I think I'd be completely content just being known as a crocheter. It sounds so bizarre, but I love it. It's part of my identity. Oprah Daily. Right. The book is your whole life told through crafting, not your shows. Sutton. It feels authentic to who I am as a person. I play all these characters. I'm always dressing up and playing with other people. I'm in London now playing Reno Sweeney in Anything Goes. She's all glamorous. I'm like, that's really fun, but that's not me. Reno doesn't crochet. But playing Reno, I crochet between scenes. It's my authentic self. Oprah Daily, you expressed earlier that you were feeling nervous about the book coming out. Have you been crafting to mitigate that anxiety? Sutton, yes. Currently, I have about 8 projects going on at the same time. I'm going on a book tour. I'm making some gifts for the moderators. I'm traveling a lot. I love to crochet when I travel. I already mapped out what I'm making on each flight, so I'm not panicked or stressed out. I'll have a finished project at the end of each flight. I've been in London for 4 months. My latest thing is collecting glass jars and crocheting little koozies for them so you can repurpose them and put pencils, crochet hooks, and flowers in them. I have 10 crocheted glass jars that I'm going to give out to my castmates. I'm constantly thinking of little projects. I've been making washcloths out of cotton yarn. We didn't have any at the flat, so I thought, I'll just make some. I'm walking to work right now, and my backpack is full of crafts. I have this idea of making covers for toilet paper rolls. I'm making a little black top hat that's going to be a toilet paper cover. It's all insanity. When life is crazy, I say, I'm going to crochet, and suddenly it all makes sense. Oprah Daily. You're always giving people gifts, but in the book you recount how your younger co-star, Peter Herman, crocheted the words thank you when the show was over. What was that like? Sutton. That man. It freaked me out because I didn't realize that he'd crocheted it. He's not a crocheter. I was like, oh, this is so sweet. You had someone make this. This is so thoughtful. And when he told me he made it, I was angry. I was so blown away at the thoughtfulness. He started talking to me about what it was like to crochet. He had a visceral reaction to it and loved it. He spent days making this thing. He's the world's best gift giver. We always say we did aggressive gift giving because we try to out-gift each other. I was blown away by that. That was one of the most thoughtful gifts I've ever received. Oprah Daily. You have a history of giving your coworkers the crafting bug. When you come to New York, you'll be starring alongside Hugh Jackman in The Music Man. Do you plan to teach him how to crochet? Sutton. You know, he's been making bread. In one of the rehearsals, he gave me a sourdough loaf. He has a sourdough starter. I'm so excited because I thought that would be such a fun thing. I want to make him bread. I want to see if he'll teach me how to make bread, and I'll teach him how to crochet. Oprah Daily. Do you have any advice for how people can find the right craft for them? Sutton. It's about getting a hobby, something that is beyond what you do for a living, something else that brings you joy. That's my biggest piece of advice. Find something that brings you joy that has nothing to do with what you do. Basically, any non-screen related activity. What I love about crafting and making something that's tangible and that exists in our hands is that at the end of the day, you can say, I made this with my time, as opposed to scrolling through Instagram for 4 hours. As far as picking a craft or starting, be gentle on yourself. You're not going to be a craft master from the get-go. It can be just for you. You don't have to open up your own Etsy store. You don't have to open it for anyone. It can be as simple as a coloring book. There are so many benefits to crafting, emotionally, mentally, everything. Being gentle on yourself and realizing that like everything else in life, it's a process. Nothing is perfect. Mistakes are part of life. It's okay if there's a missing stitch or a weird color. That's another thing to lean into with crafting. It doesn't have to be perfect. There's something about embracing those imperfections. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Netflix's Made is based on Stephanie Land's best-selling 2019 memoir. Margaret Qualley plays Alex, a young mother who, after leaving her abusive boyfriend, finds herself without any resources and no recourse to get them. Made almost proceeds like a video game with the series of obstacles Alex faces. She needs to get a job to get benefits, but can't get a job if no one can watch her daughter, Mia, who now goes by the name Story, and so on. Given the show's realistic performances and subject matter, it might not come as a surprise to you that Made is based on a true story. The 7-part series was adapted from Stephanie Land's 2019 best-selling memoir, Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. In the foreword of the memoir, Barbara Ehrenreich calls Made a window into Stephanie's world, the world of poverty. With any luck, you'll never have to end up in Stephanie's world. In Made, you will see that it's ruled by scarcity, Ehrenreich writes. Ehrenreich once spent 3 months trying to live on minimum wage as research for the book Nickel and Dimed, but Land's life wasn't an experiment. While Made is based on Land's experiences, it's reminiscent of many people's stories, which the series acknowledges with other characters Alex meets. According to the 2020 census, more than 37 million Americans live in poverty, or 11.4% of the population, and 44 million are enrolled in Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits. That said, some alterations were made in the jump from a memoir to TV. Here's how the memoir compares to the show. Made shares the same premise as Land's memoir. In the first episode of Made, Alex decides to leave her boyfriend, Sean, played by Nick Robinson, after his emotional abuse veers into the physical. Now supporting herself, this decision leads her to find work as a maid and to seek government assistance. Years ago, when I thought about my future, poverty seemed inconceivable, so far away from my reality. I never thought I would end up here. But now, after one kid and a breakup, I was smack in the middle of a reality that I didn't know how to get out of, Land writes at the start of her memoir. At another point, when moving into an emergency shelter provided by the housing authority, Land is frustrated by the long list of rules she must agree to. It's as if being poor were a crime. I was moving into a place with rules that suggested that I was an addict, dirty, or just so messed up in life that I needed an enforced curfew and pee tests. Being poor or living in poverty sounded a lot like probation, the crime being a lack of means to survive, she writes. On her website, Lan gives an idea of her daily life in those years. I relied on government assistance to survive. Child care grants, food stamps, Medicaid, utility assistance, and even gas vouchers were absolutely vital and made it possible to use my limited income for rent, because the rent always eats first. There were days in the month before the food stamp money was replenished that I went to bed hungry or ate very little. After paying bills, I often had no more than $20 left for the month. No matter how hard I worked, it never felt like it was enough, that I was enough. This was my unwitnessed existence as I polished another's to make theirs appear perfect. Land shares a daughter with her ex-boyfriend, Jamie. Alex's love for her daughter motivates her to leave Sean and sustains her while she's struggling. Like in the show, Land became unexpectedly pregnant while dating her ex-boyfriend. However, Land and Jamie's story is different than Alex and Sean's. Whereas Alex met Sean after an open mic, Land met Jamie while she was walking home after a shift at the bar. She was about 27 at the time. Both were determined to leave the town of Port Townsend, Washington, where they worked in cafes catered to tourists. Land, in particular, wanted to study creative writing in Montana. Our relationship was one with a definitive end, each of us helping the other toward the goal of getting out of town, she said. Then 4 months after meeting Jamie, Land, at the age of 28, became pregnant. As in the show, Land's pregnancy leads to conflict. Jamie is angry with her decision to keep the baby. His initial tenderness in coaxing me to change the pregnancy abruptly changed when I told him I would not be doing that. I had known Jamie only 4 months, and his rage, his hatred towards me was frightening, Land writes. At first, Land tried to make it work through a year of Jamie's abuse, threats, and screaming insults. When Story was 9 months old, she left. Another difference? How Land's parents compare to Alex's. The TV show Maid has made headlines for casting a real-life mother-daughter duo, Margaret Qualley and Andy McDowell, to play Alex and her mom Paula. In the series, Paula is an artist who lives near her daughter and has undiagnosed bipolar disorder. McDowell said her own life experiences made it easy to connect with Paula. My mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia right after I was born, McDowell told TV Insider. So it was complex, my upbringing, and I had other relationships that involved mental illness that Margaret was aware of too. So I have first-hand experience, and she knew that. But even my mother, it didn't manifest exactly the same way as Paula's. Land's mom is farther away in the memoir. She lives in England with a much younger boyfriend. After leaving Jamie, Land lived with her dad and stepmom for a short period before going to a homeless shelter. The author said Maid does her story justice. Wondering whether the author of the memoir approves of the adaptation? She emphatically does. Land posted a series of behind-the-scenes photos from the set of Maid on Instagram, alongside a heartfelt caption. Throughout this whole process of giving my story to the hands of strangers, I had to force myself to trust they'd do it justice. They have, by far. And it's because they took a true interest in learning and used their own experiences to truly understand how it feels to be food, work, and housing insecure, Land wrote. I keep using the word relief lately. It's not easy anticipating millions of people watching moments from your life that you wish your body would forget, but it has been a huge relief to know my story is in such good hands. In another post, Land called Maid an obscenely authentic visual representation of what it's like to struggle to get by. Today, Land and her family are thriving. Land documents her life on her Instagram page. She and her husband, Tim Faust, raise 4 children and have 2 dogs, including a very large St. Bernard named Keats. While Maid has a happy ending, it draws attention to the many Americans living in poverty. next article by Brian Underwood is titled, I Tried No-Needle Acupuncture to Improve My Sleep. I can appreciate intellectually the benefits of acupuncture. Studies suggest the ancient technique, a core tenet of traditional Chinese medicine, or TCM, can treat all manner of discomfort, from headaches to back and neck aches to menstrual cramps. But I've yet to try it. No amount of research has been able to alleviate my squeamishness at the thought of having lots of tiny needles stuck into my skin. So when an email with the subject line acupuncture without the needles popped up in my inbox recently, I thought, now this I could do. As it happened, I'd been feeling pretty stressed out and was experiencing bouts of insomnia, two other conditions acupuncture is believed to help, which is how I ended up a few weeks later on a massage table as naturopathic doctor and licensed acupuncturist Hector Trujillo demonstrated Tui Na on my back. Pronounced Tui Na, the practice, like acupuncture, dates back thousands of years and combines acupressure with the kind of body work you typically associate with massage. The movements are similar to Thai and Swedish techniques. We're pushing and pulling the muscle and the myofascial tissue surrounding the muscles, says Trujillo, who performs several traditional Asian wellness experiences at Seyhart, an East meets West spa-like sanctuary in Santa Monica, California. That's what Tui Na means, pushing and pulling. But these actions are also rooted in the basic principles of TCM. In Chinese medicine, good health depends on the movement of qi, or energy, along with blood and fluids, explains Chinese medicine expert David Melodew. When they're not circulating properly, your organs won't function properly, and pain and disease follow. Tui Na promotes that flow. As I lie face down, eyes closed, Trujillo focuses in on two meridians, or energy pathways, that run along my back and side. He detects several blockages in the form of knots. He uses a gua sha stone, a curved quartz massage tool, to really work out some of those stubborn kinks. I tense as he bears down, but afterward I do feel unblocked and relaxed enough not to be bothered by anything, except the thought of those needles, of course. That night I slept soundly for the first time in a couple of months. I'm ready for my next session. Our next article by Bridget Early is titled Self-Care Tips to Boost Your Mental Health. Between parenting during the pandemic, navigating makeshift work from home spaces, and dealing with staggeringly high levels of unemployment, the past year and change has given us plenty of reasons to feel anxious, stressed, and depressed, which is exactly why self-care has never been more important for women, men, kids, teens, parents, teachers, students, and, well, just about everyone. The benefits of focusing on self-awareness, of tuning into your body and taking the time to nourish it properly, are profound. Adopting self-care tips into your routine is not only vital for your mental health, but research suggests that the more we practice self-care activities, the more confident, creative, and productive we are. Not to mention that we also experience more joy, make better decisions, build stronger relationships, and communicate more effectively. Even better, there isn't a perfect, correct, or best way to approach your self-care routine. Wellness and mental health is about whatever you need to feel happier or more relaxed. For some people, that means watching a rom-com while taking a bubble bath and sipping a glass of Cabernet Sauvignon. For others, it may be whipping up an indulgent dessert, firing up a yoga app, checking in with an online therapist, going for a solo walk around the neighborhood, or buying a self-care subscription box. And for others, it's lighting a beautifully scented candle and taking an hour to read, to work on a jigsaw puzzle, or to journal. If that last one is you, might we recommend picking up Oprah's new planner? Honestly, it could even be taking a moment for self-love. Here, experts share their best self-care tips, ideas, and activities so you can start making you a priority. Stop hitting the snooze button. Many people actually build time for snoozing into their morning routine, believing it's a gentler way to wake up, but this actually causes sleep to be more disrupted, leaving the person feeling more sleepy, says Dr. Cindy T. Graham, a licensed psychologist. Instead, sleep experts recommend being honest with yourself and setting the alarm for the time you actually get up, she says. Your body will then learn to prepare for waking at that time, and you will feel less tired over the course of the day. Open the blinds as soon as you rise. Aside from waking up, the first step in your morning routine should be opening the blinds. Even just 5 minutes of sunlight first thing in the morning is said to not only boost your vitamin D levels, but also helps balance your cortisol, aka stress levels, says Kristen Oha, founder of Stat Wellness in Atlanta. Light a candle. Scientists have found that the olfactory sense is the only one with a direct link to the limbic system, the area of the brain that plays a major role in emotional regulation, memory, and behavior, says Abhi Hendra, a counselor and therapist in the United Kingdom. Use traditional calming smells such as lavender and frankincense, which research suggests lowers anxiety and depression. Also try smells that have associations with happy recollections. This could be anything from a type of candy you loved as a kid to your grandma's perfume. Get a houseplant. Besides keeping air cleaner, exposure to plants can also boost your mood. How? According to a 2015 study, active interaction with indoor plants has been shown to possibly suppress nervous system activity and reduce blood pressure, leading to an overall sense of calm. Don't exactly have a green thumb? Try a succulent or an air plant. You basically can't kill them. Or if you're more advanced, try peace lilies or erica palms. Start a side hustle. One of the best self-care tips is to simply do something you love, says Dr. Kian Vu, a clinical professor of medicine at UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine. Engaging in a hobby, whether that's knitting like Michelle Obama or creating a bullet journal, has been shown to reduce stress and can even activate genes that increase immunity and decrease inflammation, he says. Put on a face mask. A face mask is just as beneficial for your well-being as it is for your skin, because it serves as a time to take a break and treat yourself, says Dr. Jacqueline Schaefer. Make it a habit to do a weekly mask, she suggests. Trade your coffee for a soothing cup of tea. Not only does herbal tea help you stay hydrated, but the process of making and drinking a cup of tea creates a mini respite, says Dr. Carla Marie Manley, a clinical psychologist in Santa Rosa, California. Plus, whether you're trying Oprah's favorite chai or enjoying a chamomile, the simple act of tasting a soothing beverage can make the mind feel calmer and clearer, says Manley. Write in a gratitude journal. Studies have indicated that practicing gratitude has numerous benefits, including optimizing our cardiac health, reducing anxiety and depression, as well as sharpening our brain function and giving us peace of mind, says Dr. Jeff Nalen, a clinical psychologist in Malibu, California. Jot down a few things you're grateful for in a journal or on little slips of paper, then put them in a jar and set aside time to revisit them each month. If that sounds daunting, simply begin your day by thinking about someone or something you truly appreciate. Get a massage. There are many studies that show a massage doesn't just feel good in the moment, says Vu. Whether it's from your partner, a high-tech tool, or a professional, massage has been shown to relieve pain and stiffness, boost immunity, reduce anxiety and depression, lower stress and blood pressure, and increase circulation, he says. Dance without abandon. Cutting loose has very real psychological benefits, says Musselman. Simply turn up your favorite tunes or take an online dance class to get the full benefit. Eat a healthy snack. Your body requires fuel, a mixture of proteins, healthy fats, and carbohydrates, to stay healthy, balanced, and functioning, says life coach Ada Bilkus, PhD. Instead of sugary snacks, which cause blood sugar to spike and crash, opt for quick and healthy alternatives like bananas with peanut butter, veggies with hummus, a handful of almonds, granola, or Greek yogurt with blueberries. Read a joyful story each morning. According to a recent survey, more than 50% of Americans say the news causes them stress. Some say it even leads to sleep loss. One of the best expert-approved self-care tips? Trade your morning perusal through your Facebook feed with something positive, like an uplifting book or a happy podcast. Order takeout. Sometimes the best thing you can do for your mental health is take something off of your plate, says Musselman. Even if you don't typically order takeout, treat yourself every once in a while to a dinner you didn't have to cook. Same goes for a frozen meal. Say no. Most often, stress is caused by having too much to do and too little time to do it, says Dr. Jacqueline Schaefer, a board-certified doctor in L.A. Reduce your workload, prioritize your to-do list, and manage your time more effectively. This requires you to say no more often, and that's perfectly okay. There are plenty of ways to do so politely. Meditate for 5 minutes. Research shows that regular meditation can potentially undo the damaging effects of stress and calms the part of the brain responsible for the fight-or-flight response, says Ada Bilkus, life coach, PhD, ERYT, and co-founder of Health Yoga Life in Boston. Follow this self-care tip. Set your phone timer for 5 minutes. Close your eyes. Take a few deep breaths and release any tension that your body is holding on to. If you begin to wander off into other thoughts, don't judge yourself. Simply bring yourself back to the awareness of your breath, she advises. Look at pics of cute animals. Turns out all that mindless Instagram scrolling might pay some dividends. Studies show that looking at photos or videos of cute animals can increase mood and decrease stress, says Dr. Kelfern Pomeranz, a clinical psychologist in Menlo Park, California. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spagata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.